Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight to the Sydney Institute, where Malcolm Turnbull is here. Malcolm Turnbull has had a very distinguished career, but he's also been a distinguished associate member of the Sydney Institute for a long time, which we appreciate. He's well known to all of you, so I'll introduce him very briefly. Educated at Sydney and Oxford universities, he had distinguished and important careers in a number of professions, including law, business, and as an author. Since October 2004, he's been the federal MP for Wentworth, and since January 2006, in a very quick promotion, he's been the parliamentary secretary to the Prime Minister with special responsibility for the key area of water. And today he's going to talk to the Sydney Institute on water future directions. Malcolm Turnbull, many thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Jared. Now, this is not my plan for enhancing Sydney's water supply, It is certainly a very nice bit of architecture that's still with us, the Pont du Gard. I think there was a lady here earlier who said she had a few. You said you have a photograph of yourself on top of it. Tonight, I'm the Parliamentary Secretary to the Prime Minister, and my responsibility is for national water policy, which is a vital national issue. It's a vital global issue, as I'll explain in a moment. It's a fascinating issue, and I find it tends to interest just about everybody. So I'll take care not to speak for more than half an hour, so there's plenty of time for questions, because it's an issue that inspires or should inspire a lot of controversy. Now, there is, as you know, an enormous amount of water in the world. It covers 70% of the planet, and I'm just going to fix this up here. And it is constantly on the move, being recycled by the hydrological process of precipitation and then evaporation or transpiration back into the atmosphere. So the glass of water you drank today may have contained molecules of water that refreshed Leonardo or indeed washed his paintbrush, floated Noah's Ark, or even wash the blood of Caesar's toga. Water is indestructible. It's just that it isn't always in the form that we can make most use of it. Thales, the Milesian, one of the seven wise men, wrote the Roman engineer Marcus Vitruvius Pollio, taught us that water was the original cause of all things. Now, Vitruvius, like the men that built this aqueduct, was a practical man, and having noted that the priests of Egypt believe all things are composed of water and consequently thank the gods for their creation, for water's creation, he then quickly moved on in his classic book on architecture, in the water chapter, to describe how to find water, test its quality, and move it from its source to the place where it is needed, because, in his words, inasmuch as it is of infinite importance for the purposes of life, for pleasure, and for our daily use. So nothing's changed. Now, as a practical Australian, let me at the outset make two observations about water. First, it is very heavy. 1,000 litres of water is a cubic metre, and it weighs precisely 1 tonne. If you turn on the tap tonight, Sydney Water will sell it to you for a little over a dollar. If you are a dairy farmer on the Murray River at Shepparton, it will cost you 3 cents. Water has a very low value to weight ratio. Secondly, this follows from the first, water does not run uphill unless somebody or something is pushing it. As a consequence, the cost of moving water around is almost always the largest, if not the only cost, in any water scheme. Now, the management of water has always been one of the surest tests, indeed the foundation of civilization. The cradle of civilization in Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers, was an irrigation society. Sharing water, maintaining channels and other infrastructure all required a political organisation. The Romans were particularly skilled in water management. The 11 aqueducts of ancient Rome were capable of delivering 1 billion litres of water to the city every day, more water on a per capita basis than any of our major cities can provide. Of course, the Romans delivered that quantity of water entirely by gravity. Pumps didn't exist, and that of course has been our good fortune, because if the Romans had had pumps, they would not have needed to build magnificent aqueducts like this, which still march across the valleys of the Mediterranean world. But while much was different then, much was the same. The other great Roman writer on water matters was Sextus Julius Frontinus. He was the chief executive of Rome Water, or the Curator Aquarum, in the late first century, so about 100 years after Vitruvius. He wrote a book on the Roman water supply, and it's a very practical book. He sets out his experience, and he talks about challenges which would be very familiar to urban water engineers and planners. Upon his appointment, he recognised that you cannot manage what you cannot measure. Cannot manage what you cannot measure. And this actually is the fundamental premise underneath the $200 million raising national water standards element in the Australian Government Water Fund. We have to have a better understanding of our water, because if we don't know where it is, how it's connected, its interrelationship with one type of water or another, how can we responsibly use it and plan for its use? So Frontinus quickly moved to reassess the volumes of water delivered by each aqueduct, and he noted the volumes at the intake and at the end, and identified in each case where water was being lost through leaks or, and this is another timeless theme, by theft. The Romans too recognised that water should be fit for purpose. Some aqueducts had better water, which was reserved for drinking. Others had water which was fit only for gardening or cleaning. Frontinus describes the care with which the better quality water was separated from the lesser quality. So don't let anyone tell you that the dual reticulation systems at Rouse Hill are particularly novel. The Roman aqueducts are a salutary reminder that the challenge of providing water to large populations is not new, and that the necessity for commitment, coordination, and above all leadership is as great today as it was in the days of the Caesars. The world today faces a grave water crisis. All those areas that are coloured red and brown have less than 1,000 cubic metres, or less than 2,000 cubic metres per person per year, and the red parts have less than 1,000 cubic metres of water per person per year. And this is a forecast to 2030, and it basically tells you that much of the world's population is either in a position of real water scarcity or looming water scarcity. Now, we are all familiar with the water crisis in North Africa and the Middle East, but the greatest challenge is actually looming in northern India and northern China. Over the last 40 years, we've seen a green revolution, an explosion of agricultural production in the developing world. It's been made possible in large measure by technology. But it's not just better crops and better fertilisers. The key element in that technology has been the introduction of inexpensive pumps. The green revolution has been made possible by the extraction of groundwater. Groundwater is a particularly valuable resource. It holds about 30% of the world's freshwater resources, most of which is locked up in glaciers. But in many cases, it's being extracted at a rate which far exceeds the rate of recharge from the environment. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about China just as an example, because this global perspective is very important. That's a rainfall map of China, and again, the red and the brown and the yellow are areas of low rainfall. Higher rainfall is the green and the blue. And as you can see, northern China and western China is either low rainfall or arid. Since 1998, in northern China, where about half the population live, there has been a drought, very serious drought, drinking water distributed by trains. I noted that the international standard for water availability is 1,000 cubic metres a year per person. In Tianjin, one of the biggest Chinese cities in the north, they've got 160 cubic metres of water available per year per person. In many towns, it's much less than that. This is a sketch map of the North China Plain. That North China Plain feeds about 400 to 500 million people, nearly half the population of China. It is 75%, the agriculture there is 75% dependent on the extraction of groundwater. In the sort of hatched area, this is the water that's being extracted there is from shallow aquifers, and they have declined by more than 20 metres since serious pumping started in the 1960s. The areas that are shaded a bit, sort of a light grey, have declined by more than 40 metres. They are now falling by more than 5 metres a year. The leading Australian hydrologist, Rick Evans, whose slides these are, and who works with the World Bank there in northern China, estimates that within 15 years, this groundwater resource will no longer be available. How is China going to feed 400, 500 million people when the essential element in their agricultural base is gone? That's just a cross-section of the aquifer, and you can see there the, that's going from the mountains in the west, and you can see the grey, the brackish water, starting to enter into the groundwater. Remember, water runs downhill. If you extract groundwater next to the coast, inevitably seawater will penetrate it. And that's why, for example, in some parts of the world, in Israel and in California in particular, they are replenishing aquifers, and I'll talk a little bit about that in the context of Sydney in a moment, in order to, if you like, push the seawater back out. Because once that seawater comes in, of course, you destroy your resource altogether. Now, what about Australia, however? How badly off are we? Well, we say we are the driest vegetated continent, and that's true. There's our annual rainfall. And you can see that much of the country, these are in millimetres, so 50 millimetres is roughly 2 inches. And you can see that the bulk of our water is around the north, and the centre of the country has very little water. Having said that, while we are the driest vegetated continent, remember that if you take that arid centre out, our average rainfall is about 700 mils, which is a little bit more than, say it's about half of the rainfall of certainly this part of Sydney. So it's not not too bad. This is an important thing to bear in mind here. This is the distribution of our water, and this is the runoff. Now remember, rainfall and runoff are two very different things. If you have a hot climate, most of your rainfall will go up straight up into the air in evaporation. Or if it's picked up by plants, it'll be quickly transpired. But you can see that notwithstanding the heat in the north, almost all of our runoff, or two-thirds of our runoff, occurs in the north. The Murray-Darling Basin, that green bit there, has 75% of our irrigated agriculture and nearly half of all of our agricultural production. But it has only 6% of our runoff. Australia is very flat. It's very poorly drained, and because it's an old continent, it's very nutrient depleted. That has a very, very major impact on the Murray-Darling Basin. The Murray-Darling Basin is a big catchment, as we saw in the previous slide, but it only has one outlet at the Murray mouth. It is very, very flat. And I think, I'll just check this figure, I think it drops by about 200 metres in 200 metres in 1,000 kilometres. Yes, it drops only 2,000 metres over 1,000 kilometres. So it is very, very flat. It has very low energy. And what that means is, unlike the rivers of North America and Europe, which have very large volumes where the gradients are steeper, it's very hard to flush all the salts and sediments out. So we have a landscape which has a lot of salt because part of it's been under the ocean, and indeed you've got wind-blown salts from the ocean, particularly in Western Australia. And because it's flat and the rain, there isn't a great deal of rainfall, it's very hard to get that salt out. That has a major impact for our, you know, for our irrigated agriculture. Now, we can see there, just giving you an idea of where the catchments have been modified, and you can see all around the east coast and indeed in the southwest corner, we've made very significant impacts on our environment. This is an interesting slide because it shows you the variability of our rivers. Most of the major rivers in the world, the difference between a high year and a low year might be two or three, maybe four times. The difference between a low year and a high year on the Darling is 10,000 times. On the Murray River, it's 5,000 times. So our landscape has enormous variability. And we have managed to deal with that, of course, by building massive dams. This is an example, a very significant graph. Many of you may have seen it before, but it is a very salutary one. This is the inflow, the stream flow into Perth's dams. There's Perth, a city of over 1 million people. And you look at the green line, shows the average storage inflow from 1911 to 1974. And then look at the step down, 75 to 96, and then down again to 97, 2004. The upshot of that is that Perth has lost two-thirds of its stream flow in the period that its population has doubled. So a good question is, are we going through long-term change or short-term pain? Now, blue means more rain, red means less rain. If you look, the slide on the right, the Australia on the right, is the difference from 1950 to 2003, and you can see very significant changes on the East Coast, very significant reductions in rainfall. If you look at it over the 100 years, however, the changes are not so great. And this is one of the problems that we have. We don't know whether we are dealing with a real shift, a major shift, a long-term shift in climate, which is a conclusion you could reasonably draw from the slide I showed you about Perth, or whether this is just a blip. The middle of last century was particularly wet, so the averages look bad. Of course, a lot of planning was based in that. One of the major focuses of all of our water policy is the Murray River. Why? Well, that's where 75% of the irrigation is to be found. It's where around half of our agricultural production is to be found. And certainly by far the most profitable agriculture, the most productive agriculture, if you like, is in irrigation. Now, one of the major initiatives of the Howard government is a commitment to acquire 500 gigalitres of water from productive use, from agricultural use, to be restored to the environment, to ensure that a number of iconic sites, and they're identified there, six iconic sites, mostly wetlands, on the river can be watered. Because you see, what we have done by regulating the river is we've reversed its normal flow. You see, the days before the Big Cume Dam and the Dartmouth Dam and all of those huge storages we've built on that system to deliver water for irrigators, the river was full in winter and spring. That's when it ran. But of course, the irrigators, the farmers, need their water in late summer and autumn. So what we do when we regulate a river, we actually reverse its normal cycle. And so we store the winter rains up in the hills as best we can, and then we release them during the summer when they need it. And the consequence has been that a lot of those floods upon which the wetlands depended are no longer available, or they are in effect over flooded during the summer period when they should be dry. And so a great deal of management has to go into that. But the point about this slide is that to some extent we are chasing after a water situation that is being constantly affected by climate change. We know that we appear to be going through into hotter and drier seasons. This year, the last 5 years, and this year in particular, have been the driest years in the Murray-Darling system. In the Murray, in the southern Murray, the Darling, as you know, is very variable particularly, but in the southern Murray system, we are in the worst drought ever since records began. So we appear to have climate change. We also are losing a lot of water from groundwater extraction. Now, I talked a bit about China's groundwater, and I'll show you a slide in a moment that's very illustrative of the problems with groundwater. Historically, people regarded groundwater as being like anything else that was under the ground, almost like a mineral. So you could just dig it up, pump it out, and it was yours. But groundwater, just like that molecule of water that started off with Leonardo's paintbrush and ended up in your glass of water this morning, groundwater is almost invariably on the move, and it is directly connected with surface water. So you pull water out of the ground, you pull a megalitre out of the ground, that's a megalitre that is very likely not to find its way to a stream. And that's why over-extraction of groundwater, which is a big part of our challenge of the National Water Initiative, one of the things we have to confront, has a major impact. Obviously, the more farmers that put in dams, I'm sure many people here, including myself, have got farming interests. You build a dam, it catches water, that water would have otherwise found its way into a creek, found its way into an aquifer and so forth. And of course, plantation forestry, a lot of people forget that trees use a lot of water. A hectare of blue gums soaks up a lot of water. Now, if you've got rising water tables and you want to lower them, that might be just the ticket. But in some places, plantation forestry will materially affect and negatively affect stream flow. This is an interesting slide. It just reminds us of the increase, and the figures are a bit out of date, but it reminds you of the increase in groundwater extractions. Do you know in the last 20 years, we have doubled the amount of water we've pulled out of our rivers, our surface water for irrigation, and trebled the amount we've pulled out of the ground for irrigation. So it's a bit like some of you may remember the old 6 o'clock swill when the pubs closed at 6 o'clock. And just as the minute hand was getting to the 12, everyone would order more rounds of drinks because they wanted to belt them down before the publican said, that's it. It's time, gentlemen, please. So we have actually, just as we have become aware of how scarce and affected our water resources are, we've been increasing our reductions. Now, this is something, just a little bit of a slide to talk about groundwater. In the top one, you can see a typical situation where there's the recharge area, the rain comes down, it goes into the soil, and it runs into the river. More than half of the stream flow of our southern rivers in Australia come from groundwater. You can think of the river as a channel running through a sponge, and the water's seeping out of the sponge into the river. But here in the second slide, we've put down a bore, and so you can see we're lowering the water table. So less water is running into the river, and we've reduced the flow into the river. If we reduce it enough, however, the river becomes, instead of being what the hydrologists call a gaining stream, it becomes a losing stream, and the water flows out of the stream into the ground. And this is what's happened in China and in parts of the United States too. This is why the Yellow River doesn't flow very often. Because even when there is rain and there is flow in the river, it is being drawn down into the groundwater to replenish that groundwater table. And because groundwater moves so slowly, the fastest aquifer that I'm aware of in Australia is the one in Centennial Park, the Botany Aquifer, which I'll come to in a minute. And it's a real exocet, sort of an XPT of aquifers. The water there moves at 150 metres a year. In most of these, and it's pretty steep because of it's got about 40 metres head down to Botany Bay. In most of the, in a few kilometres, you can imagine how slowly the groundwater moves in the Murray-Darling Basin because it's so flat and because, of course, it's not moving through sand. So what that means is that you can over-extract groundwater today and then you can wake up to it and you can say, right, we've done the wrong thing, we're going to cap those extractions, get them back to a sensible level. The impact of that over-extraction may not be felt in the streams and the rivers for many decades to come. And those of you that have interests in the Southern Highlands will know what I'm talking about in terms of the Kangaroon Aquifer, which is very, very poorly understood. As the water is pulled, if that is mined for water, as Mr. Yemmer is proposing, that will have a direct impact on the streams. And the impact may be one that is not felt for many, many years. So long after the generation of water planners and politicians have passed away, you will be paying, the environment will be paying the cost of that over-extraction. Just a reminder of how short of water we are, that's what our cities will look like if we do not find additional water. Now, of course, we can manage with some water restrictions. I don't see any reason why we should ration water any more than I don't see why we should be rationing water on a permanent basis any more than we should be rationing electricity. But you can see that if there are no increases in supply, the reduction in per capita consumption by 2030 will be enormous. We need to get additional water into our cities. That's just a slide that shows you the difference between demand as the yellow line in Melbourne, supply as the blue line. If you assume there's no increase in supply and no climate change, there's a gap. If you assume even a low climate change scenario, the gap starts to get very large indeed. This is an interesting slide. Perth, as you know, has got very, very severe water problems. And they, unlike any other city, has got access to large groundwater resources. And they are doing everything. And this is the cost per kilolitre, per 1,000 litres of all of their measures. So desalination is the most expensive at $1.16. Groundwater is pretty expensive. The cheapest source of water is actually thinning out the catchments, just cutting down some of the trees in the catchments so that they get more runoff into their dams. And recycling is about just a wee bit cheaper than desalination. As you can see in our cities, that's basically the position with the dams. The Darwinians are all right. Everybody else has got a challenge. Southeast Queensland they're in the middle of an election that is in large measure based on arguments about water are particularly challenged. One issue which I've addressed in a paper I've published recently, a discussion paper on private sector participation in the water industry, is how do we get more competition into the water industry, particularly the urban water industry. I mean, we have seen enormous productivity gains in Australia through competition reform in gas and electricity, in telecommunications, yet there hasn't been a great deal in water, not yet, because it's dominated by big government-owned monopolies. One of the challenges is that water is very cheap. So there you see some of the retail prices for water, but just remember that there is virtually no additional sources of water in any of our cities for a cost of less than $1.20 a kilolitre. So we are pricing water almost invariably at a cost lower than the cost of actually getting more water, which of course provides a disincentive for investment. That's just a slide that shows, again, the increase in temperature in New South Wales. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Sydney and a particularly interesting opportunity right here, just a few kilometres away from us. As you know, the state government has abandoned its plans for a desalination plant, seems to be reluctant to take on recycling on a large scale, and has said that it has some opportunities with some fractured rock aquifers, in particular at Kangaroon and at Leonay at Penrith. Mangrove Mountain is quite a good aquifer, but as you would know, the Central Coast is desperately short of water, and if you pump any more water out of that aquifer, you'll only make the Central Coast problem worse. So that's really out of the question. But each of these aquifers, Leonay and Southern Highlands, are only... very little's known about them, really, and they're only expected to produce water over a short period. The biggest aquifer, the one with the most water, is actually the Botany Sands. And there it is. That's from Google Earth. And up the top there, you can see Centennial Park and Queen's Park. You can see the showground, Moore Park. And then as you come down into the middle bit, you can see the golf courses that run down to Botany Bay. Now, there is, and there was some, the last week I convened a meeting of everybody that knew anything about the Botany Aquifer. Now, in particular, Professors Ian Ackworth from UNSW and Noel Merrick from UTM and a number of other people. Because there is an opportunity here to develop in a very sustainable way a substantial additional water source for Sydney. How does it work? Well, water, get a lot of water in the eastern suburbs, a lot of rain in the eastern suburbs, a lot more than you do in the Warragamba catchment. And the water comes in at the north, it runs down into the ponds in Centennial Park, and it soaks into the ground and then works its way down to the bottom, down to Botany Bay at about 150 metres a year. Well, isn't it poisoned, people would say. Well, certainly right down in the pink area around the old ICI plant and what's called the Botany Industrial Park, it is particularly unpalatable, dangerous. And indeed, Orica, the successor company to ICI, has established a large recycling plant there, which is pumping the water out so it cannot get into Botany Bay, and then removing the toxins and then actually selling the recycled water to other industrial users. The government has also advised people not to extract water from bores in these yellow areas, where there are a number of other sources of industrial pollution, not universal, but because, of course, there's been a lot of industrial activity there over the years. Even petrol stations can cause a lot of leakage. But fortunately, the northern part of the aquifer, and indeed most of the aquifer, is relatively pristine. This is a complete accident because it's all parks, largely parks. The quality of the water in the upper Botany aquifer is, with the exception, and these slides are all from Professors Merrick and Ackworth, is with the exception of a higher concentration of iron, which comes out of the sandstone and which is very easy to remove, is actually, on all of those measures, cleaner than Sydney tap water. That's from a bore at the bottom of Centennial Park. And what's fascinating about that is you have all of the storm water from Bondi Junction. Notwithstanding that my electorate office is there, I wouldn't take a cup of water out of the gutter on a rainy day in Bondi Junction, but that rushes all the way down into Centennial Park, and by the time it gets to the bottom of the park, to the racecourse, it's pretty much clean. One of the possibilities for using this aquifer is to use it to recharge it and to either direct more storm water into it, or which would require some engineering work, naturally, or indeed to recycle wastewater, because there's obviously two big sewage plants, both to the north and the south, Bondi and Malabar, recycle that water to a very high standard of purity and then recharge it into the aquifer. You could pump it back in, as this slide shows, or simply just use it to fill the ponds. That's a technique that's used in many parts of the world, particularly in California, as I said, but also now in projects that we are supporting through the Australian Government Water Fund in Adelaide and in Western Australia. What that would enable you to do is to keep all of those ponds there full all year round. The water would go through the sands and would be removed, or could be removed, after 10, 15 years of travelling sedately through those sands. Now, I've touched on a few issues and I'm over my 30 minutes. I haven't talked about the National Water Initiative, but I would simply say to you, we are better situated than any country in the world to deal with our water challenge. It is a global challenge. We're better situated for three reasons. Firstly, we have more water than a lot of other places. Admittedly, it isn't all in the right place, but we have water. More importantly, we're a prosperous country. We have the technology and the science to ensure that we can maximise the water we have to recycle if we need to go to that step to desalinate. Secondly, we have a national commitment to water policy and water reform. The National Water Initiative, which would send those of you that are still awake completely asleep if I gave you a long speech about that, is a vital document because it sets out the framework for ensuring that our water future is both secure and sustainable, bringing allocations back to a sustainable level, giving security to those entitlements, and then enabling them to trade. Why? Not because we're pious defenders of the sainted memory of Adam Smith, even though many of us are, but because it is only the market that can allocate any scarce resource to its most efficient users. But finally, the reason I believe we are better situated than most countries is because of this. This is the wonderful thing I found in a great new book that hasn't come out yet by Daniel Connell about the Murray-Darling Basin Commission, and he pulled this out. In a democracy, boredom works for bureaucracies and corporations as smell works for a skunk. It keeps danger away. Power does not have to be exercised behind the scenes. It can be open. The audience is asleep. The modern world is forged amidst our inattention. Now, it is our obligation, and my obligation certainly as the PM's secretary, parliamentary secretary for water, to ensure that we maintain a lively and engaged debate about water issues, because we have been too complacent right around Australia about water, and we have been asleep. We, the audience, have been asleep because the water planning has been too dull. Well, it's no longer dull. It's the difference between prosperity and falling behind. In many places, it's the difference between life and death. We are equal to the water challenge. It is a great one. And the key to ensuring that we meet it and that we hold governments, state governments, national governments, local governments to account is to ensure that we have a lively debate that is an informed debate and that we don't allow bureaucracy to benefit and planners to benefit from a bored and inattentive audience. As long as we are awake, as long as the debate is lively, as long as it is well informed, that is the best platform for good policy. And that's why I thank Sydney Institute and Anne and Jared very much for inviting me to speak to you tonight. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.